Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight for our inaugural Jim and Jeanette Bain occasional lecture. Most unusually tonight, I'm going to say a few words at the start before I introduce our speaker, Catherine Birbal-Singh. And I just want to explain why this lecture has been set up, and we're going to do it every now and then as we can. In late 1986, I was working as Chief of Staff for John Howard, the then Leader of the Opposition. A letter arrived from Jim Bain, who I knew as the Managing Partner of Bain & Company, and whom I had occasion to meet when working with John Howard. And Jim's message in his letter, these were the days of letters, was straightforward and short, a feature of his written and spoken communications, I found out. He had taken over as chairman of an old public policy institute which was in its death throes, and he was looking for someone who could be executive director with a review to reviving the organisation. And I agreed to meet Jim for lunch at what is now the Sofitel Wentworth Hotel, and to cut a long story short, I said I would be willing to take the job myself. There was only one understanding. I would work hard, and Jim and Jeanette Bain would make a substantial personal financial contribution for 3 years, for 1987, for 1988 and 1989, and then the situation would be reassessed. And when I commenced at the Institute's head in January 1987 in Young Street, on the site of what is now Governor Philip Tower, in other words, on this very site down in Young Street, we did not have the money to survive the first year, but within months support, both financial and in terms of membership, increased. And in January 1987, Les Hollins, who was then editor-in-chief of The Australian, asked me to write a weekly column for The Australian. I moved to the Sydney Morning Herald 3 years later. Les Hollins became our deputy chairman, deputy to Jim, at the old Institute. And Les was emphatic that the Institute should not interfere in any way with the content of my column, and it never did, and it never has. In 1987 and 1988, the Institute did relatively well, so much so that our board decided that we should go our own way with a new name to reflect our new standing as a policy forum devoted to debate and discussion, where a variety of views would be heard and subsequently published. Jim Bain, Jim Creer, Noel Foley, Phil Scanlon and Les Hollins, among others, were involved in closing down the old Institute and opening up the Sydney Institute. Jim did not continue as chairman of the new Institute, but he remained as a strong supporter. He even rented rooms in our office for some years. And Jim and Jeanette Bain have attended every one of our annual lectures. The Sydney Institute itself was born on the 31st of March 1989, and we moved into our current office at 41 Phillip Street on the 1st of July in 1989. And Anne Henderson commenced on that date, and the frenetic activity, which those of you who receive our emails will be well aware of, that has come to be associated with the Sydney Institute commenced around this time. Over 2 decades have passed since then, and the Sydney Institute has achieved quite extraordinary name recognition for what is in reality a small organisation. We could not have survived all these years without our corporate supporters, our associate members, and the 1,000 or more speakers who have addressed our public forums, from prime ministers to a young female university student who spoke about her book on anorexia. But above all, we could not have made it without the initial support, the encouragement and the generosity of Jim and Jeanette Bain. At a recent annual dinner lecture, our chairman, Nick Johnson, announced that we would be establishing a Jim and Jeanette Bain occasional lecture for which we would invite someone from overseas to talk about a matter of public importance. And the team at the Sydney Institute are most grateful that Catherine Birbal-Singh accepted this invitation to deliver the inaugural Jim and Jeanette Bain lecture on the topic of London education and the London riots. Many thanks to Qantas for flying Ms. Birbal-Singh to Australia. Thanks also to the Four Seasons Hotel. And special thanks again to Jim and Jeanette Bain on this very special occasion. now for something very Sydney Institute. Catherine Birbalsing is a British teacher and perhaps Britain's most outspoken and controversial teacher. She was educated at a comprehensive school. She earned a degree in philosophy and modern languages at Oxford University and has taught for over a decade in inner city schools. To Miss With Love, the book, which is now out, was for several years an anonymous blog that exposed the reality of inner city schools and the problem with the education system in Britain, or well, in England. Catherine Birbalsing now writes regularly for The Telegraph and occasionally for the Sunday Times, and she's given evidence at the Commons Select Committee for Education. And her views have sparked a national debate, both with the publication of her book and more particularly as a commentator on the London riots. And so, Catherine Birbalsing, you're very welcome to address the Sydney Institute on London education and the London riots. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. It's good of you to come out tonight to hear me. Thank you. When I became a teacher, some 12 years ago in London, I genuinely believed that the only way one could make a difference to the underprivileged was to work for the state. And I believed that state education stimulated social mobility. But my time teaching in some of London's inner city schools has taught me much, and I've seen things that you would never believe. As every year ticked by, I became more and more frustrated with the lies we teachers were having to tell the public. We had to pretend that our schools were better than they were in order to trick parents into sending us their children. 93% of our children in Britain are educated in the state sector, and there is a great divide between the private and state sectors. The state sector is always trying to prove that they are just as good as the private sector, if not better. And because everyone knows deep down that that simply isn't true, let's face it, British children are now rated 16th in the world for science, 25th for reading, and 28th for maths, according to the 2009 Programme for International Student Assessment, so the PISA report. And the 2000 PISA report ranked British children as 4th for science, 7th for reading, and 8th for maths. We now spend £80 billion a year, double what we spent in the 1990s, on education, and yet British school children have plummeted in the international league tables. So I wrote a book, To Miss With Love, with the intention of it being published anonymously, because I knew just how dangerous it was to speak the truth. But then before publication, I spoke at the Conservative Party conference in October 2010, last year, about our broken education system and revealed some of my thoughts on what I thought needed fixing. As a British teacher recently told me, there was nothing that I said in the speech that teachers don't say every day in staff rooms across the country. We simply aren't allowed to say it out loud. And the state school system literally prevents its teachers from speaking their minds. The riots in London did not come as a surprise to British teachers. We have not only been predicting that kind of general chaos for years, but we experience it on a daily basis in our schools. We have many Australian teachers who enter the school system as supply teachers in England, and generally they are shocked by what they see and experience in our classrooms. And it's the same for German, French, or Spanish teachers. The only visiting teachers who are used to our behaviour problems and low standards are those who come from the American inner cities. And riots, of course, are not unfamiliar to them. The difference between the American and British school systems is that the international community knows just how bad American schooling can be. But Britain still lives off its old reputation as the mother country, leading the Commonwealth and its empire and all that is true and good. But the real truth is that not only does the state in Britain tie teachers' hands, but it does the same to parents, resulting in a breakdown of authority both in our schools and in our homes. Some parents try desperately to bring their children up properly and struggle. I have spent my career meeting parents who are brought to tears because of their unruly teenagers. Some say that they cannot discipline their children because their children threaten to call the police and cry abuse. Every time their child misbehaves, rather than being able to discipline them properly, they remember their neighbor or their friend or their cousin who was handcuffed in their own house and hauled away by the police, their children put into social care for the night because of some made-up story. I remember one Jamaican woman pleading with me in school, desperately wanting to discipline her daughter, but the parenting classes she was attending at the local council suggested she use more praise. And she said to me, "But how can I always be praising her when she gets so much wrong? The prizes for all culture doesn't just exist in our schools. It is endemic in our society to a point where not only do we not question it, but those who have old school values are forced to conform to the gold stars for everyone mantra dictated by the state. The same thing happens at school. The bad children are constantly receiving prizes simply for remaining quiet or for turning up on time. The teachers, in order to win round the bad children, are taught by their line managers and teacher training institutions that praise is what is needed to motivate children. So we all use it to saturation point, devaluing the worth of the gold star. Meanwhile, the good children, who are left in the dark because no one notices them, become bad in an effort to gain some attention. Eventually, the cool gangster lifestyle that these children have pumped into their minds 6 to 7 hours per day, and when I survey them, that's how much they watch MTV, takes over. Their understanding of success is not marriage, a job, and a couple of kids. It's cars, women, and bling. Our bookshops were not looted, and if you didn't have a sports or mobile phone shop on your high street, you knew your community was probably safe. Who allows our children to watch so much MTV? The very parents who are exhausted because their children are spiraling out of control, and yet they are told by the council that they should use more praise, or the single parents who are encouraged to stay single by the state with promises of free flats and welfare checks. The schools struggle to keep order, partly because of the low standards of the education system, but also because teachers are encouraged to constantly do group work and entertain the children. Children must never be bored. And if they are, or if they disrupt, it is the teacher's fault. Children are never held to account for what they do. Is it any wonder that some of them decided to show the police that they were in charge and went out looting? State schools ought to promote social mobility. They ought to. They should not simply perpetuate the class system and ensure that those who go to private schools are taught well, and only those in leafy suburb middle-class state schools stand a chance at a half-decent education. Unfortunately, a number of people with power believe that the way to improve our education for children is to ban tradition in our classrooms, stop being so fuddy-duddy, and appeal to children by making things more fun. We believe it is unfashionable to have desks in rows. And so some schools actually ban traditional rows in favor of always having desks in groups. Some schools abandon the more traditional academic subjects altogether and don't teach them at all. In an effort to raise their standing in the league tables, schools will have children take drama, PE, or media studies, abandoning history, physics, or French to do so. And our so-called progressive thinkers rejoice, saying that these subjects are more suited to certain children. It is funny how the children who these subjects suit are never their own. The tradition of competition, which we celebrate in the world of sport, has become unfashionable in the academic classroom, and innovation requires that children never be given grades and are never allowed to know where they stand in comparison to their peers. Tradition in education has become a dirty word and is reserved for the elite, while innovation is what is given to the poor. The irony is that the rejection of all that is traditional comes from people who were themselves beneficiaries of a very traditional education. But remembering some of their own classes at school as being boring, are now trying to reform the education system for these children to make it more interesting. So they can be very well-meaning people. Richard Branson, for instance, who famously dropped out of school at 15, he thinks schools over-educate children and stunt the sparks of early entrepreneurship. Well, what Branson forgets is that he had the most traditional of educations, having been educated at one of Britain's top private schools, and yet he is the most extraordinary entrepreneur. Branson underestimates just how much his education has contributed to his success. What Branson was able to take away at age 15 from school far outstrips the standard of education that some of our youngsters are currently accessing even at university level. Some of our university degrees now are the equivalent in standard to what children used to do at age 15 in school in the 1970s. Branson would probably find these degrees ludicrously easy. General thinking around school being boring makes it possible for us to have reached a stage where teachers are no longer expected to teach, and instead they must be facilitators of learning with constant group work going on, where the teacher is rarely standing in the front of the class, but instead moves amongst the children who are all busy doing something. The idea here is that doing is more interesting than listening, and this may very well be true. But the problem comes when we think that doing needs to happen most of the time. That means that the teacher, a great source of knowledge, almost becomes redundant as a fountain of knowledge, and instead becomes a bit of a referee. We don't value the importance of teaching knowledge for the children to then do something with that knowledge. Innovation is considered to only be doing, a complete rejection of what is tradition. The problem is that we all underestimate the knowledge that we have and use every day. Try to read any article in the newspaper and you'll find that there is an assumption of background knowledge. You can't just look it up on the internet. Recently, I read an article about Carla Bruni, for instance. To understand the title and subtitle, one would have to know who she was. She was married to Nicolas Sarkozy, and you'd have to know that he was the president of France, and what being a president means. And indeed, you'd have to know what France is. Is it a city? Is it a country? Is it in Europe? Now, you may laugh. You may laugh, but I have, as a teacher, had conversations with 14-year-olds where they simply don't understand the difference between France and Paris. For them, it's all the same. I can't tell you the number of times I've had conversations with children about Winston Churchill, where they think he's that dog on the insurance advert that they often see on television. And I'll just read you a small extract from the book, which is on, it's a diary, so this is Saturday the 3rd of May. I have organized a trip to Oxford University. I managed to get some money from school to pay for the coach and the kids, and the kids make up the difference with a £5 contribution. The most extraordinary thing about it is that we're going on a Saturday, and they aren't missing school, and yet they still want to go. I can't wait to show them the different colleges, explore some history together, and open up their eyes. We're on the coach, gliding through some beautiful countryside with the sun beating down. I warn you, the children's names are quite interesting. When Dopey leaps up, his face pressed against the window. "Look, man, look!" he shouts out. Dreamer, beautiful, seething, furious, and all the others look round, out the window. Dopey bangs on the window. "It's a cow, man!" Dreamer squashes his face against the window too. "Yeah, man, it's a cow." "Yes, boys, it's a cow. What's the big deal?" "But it's real, Miss." Dopey laughs hysterically. "It's a real cow, man." I put my hands on Dopey's head and shake them as if there were something rattling inside. The others laugh. Seething's annoyed and she folds her arms across her chest. "What's wrong, Seething?" I say. "Miss, how long is this trip? And what's so special about Oxford Circus anyway?" Suddenly it strikes me. They have no idea where we're going. "We're going to Oxford University. It's in a town called Oxford, which is about an hour and a half out of London. David Cameron went to Oxford. Lots of people in government went there. I want you to see things you've only ever seen on TV." Dopey and Dreamer burst into laughter. "Raw, man, that's already happened, miss. Didn't you see that cow?" Okay. Ordinary people don't realise just how little some of our kids know. What we also forget is that the very thing that got us to where we are now was the kind of education we all had. Our teachers actually teaching us knowledge, so that we know the difference between Paris and France, are sometimes being bored in lessons and learning the discipline to struggle on through. How many people in business clinch a deal because they know the soft skills of being polite, know how to sit through a boring lecture, and are able to concentrate enough to still pick up what is necessary to impress the client? It is through the study of tough, rigorous academic subjects that soft skills are often acquired. Traditional educations are not bad, and most of the progressives perpetuating this nonsense in our schools have benefited from one themselves. In other words, they climb the ladder to the top and then unwittingly pull the ladder up from under them. So in the last 30 years, the concept of teaching knowledge in our classrooms has nearly disappeared altogether. Teaching historical facts, lists of vocab which rely on memory skills, is considered old-fashioned. Instead, we think it better to inspire children to be creative through group discussion and project work. But background knowledge is absolutely essential to enable children to capture new ideas. For instance, when cars were first invented, they were called horseless carriages. So to understand the concept of a car, the new concept of a car, one had to have knowledge of horses and of carriages, and the idea of something being less something else. In fact, modern neuroscience has shown that in order to grasp new concepts, pupils require a great deal of background knowledge. As background knowledge is provided unequally in different homes, it is our duty in schools to level out that playing field. In some homes, children are lucky enough to have tutors employed, conversations over dinner with their parents about the day's news events, and as such, they can pick up facts about history, geography, and science as they go. But instead of ensuring that all of our children should have access to that knowledge in our schools, we turn away from knowledge acquisition, which is considered boring, and teach skills like being empathetic or forming a point of view through what is a very seductive and seemingly better way of teaching. It seems more fun, and the progressives like the idea of finally breaking free from the restriction of their own educational backgrounds. So putting desks in rows is considered archaic, rote learning is abandoned completely, even the idea of classrooms having walls is rejected, encouraging chaos all around, and our children are quite literally leaving school without basic knowledge in English, maths and history. A recent study from the University of Sheffield showed that 17% of the children leaving school in Britain are functionally illiterate. Schools, quite simply, need classrooms, and classrooms in turn require walls. When I first told my father that we were spending billions of pounds on schools building wall-less classrooms, he was baffled. You see, he grew up in poverty-stricken Guyana in South America, where he went to a school that had no walls because they couldn't afford them. So for us to now spend billions recreating what the developing world is trying to move away from seems like lunacy, and yet this is exactly what we're doing. If we want to equip our children with the power to change the world, they must first have knowledge of it and understand it. Unfortunately, the progressives think that somehow knowledge is right-wing and boring. And this is simply not true. What makes Tony Benn, the well-known British socialist who has campaigned against injustice all over the world, such a great speaker? Or what gave Ian Fleming such a creative mind that he should create James Bond? And what ensured that Winston Churchill should be an inspirational leader, moving back and forth between liberal and conservative parties? What ensured that Obama would be the first black American president? Their very traditional educations. Thomas Jefferson had a classical education, but was so forward-thinking that he signed the Declaration of Independence. And Mark Zuckerberg is obsessed with classics, but is the founder of the transformational and innovative Facebook. What made these people into successes was the traditional educations that they had, the inspirational teachers who taught them, the love of learning that they picked up with their walled classrooms, desks in rows, and with the teacher teaching from the front. Traditional education these days in Britain is reserved only for the rich. Yet tradition is what has given us our most explosive revolutionaries around the world. Stokely Carmichael, who led the Black Panthers movement and was a major player in the rights in civil rights, dropped gang life, so inspired was he at his science specialist school, and so busy was he reading Darwin and Marx. Mandela went to an elite Methodist school. Revolutions are created with traditional thinking. That doesn't mean you can't ever do any type of group work, or you can't ever go onto a computer. But it should not be a fight to have a school system where our poorest children should have access to an education that includes knowledge acquisition, competition, a non-prizes for all culture, high standards of behavior, in an environment where everyone reaches for the best. This is where I believe there could be a real role for free schools in our inner cities in Britain. Our Conservative government has brought out these new proposals, copying the free school movement in Sweden and the charter school movement in America. This month, in September, our first batch of free schools opened. There were 24 of them. As free schools are free to do what is best for their children and do not have their hands tied behind their backs by the state, they are able to reject the cultural pressure that is felt in some of our ordinary state schools and do something different. They are free to provide children with the tradition that is found in our better private schools. They can offer an extended day, lessons that are about knowledge acquisition, and competition to drive up standards. They can provide classrooms with desks and rows, and they can offer more traditional subjects. And by this, I don't necessarily mean Latin. I simply mean the opportunity to do some Spanish or history, the chance to study biology and chemistry and physics as separate subjects. The tradition of benchmarking children can be upheld. Standing at assembly and holding high standards for uniform and behavior can simply become part of the norm. In fact, bringing traditional thinking of this kind is to trailblaze and indeed be innovative. How wonderful it is that the free school movement should allow individuals in any community to take responsibility, to know what issues face their particular community, and to have the freedom to set up a school that can do something positive and new. So I am trying to set up a free school in the depths of South London to do exactly what I say is needed, and educate these children in such a way so that the riots like the ones that we witnessed last month will not happen again. The ordinary people of South London, the poor, the single-parent families, are desperate for another choice of school in that area because there aren't enough school places, and they know how generally awful the schools are. Yet there are those of us from the National Union of Teachers or Socialist Workers' Party who oppose free schools and oppose us and shout things at us like Tory teachers and so on, and literally picket our information evenings. And it has to be said that those people they all are the middle classes. People who can afford to make up for their own state schools, they have children, they can make up for their state schools' issues by employing tutors at home. And they want to stop free schools from opening because they hate the idea of individuals taking away responsibilities and power from the state. The only way our poorest children can succeed is for them to receive the same quality of education as our richest, clearly. They need the privilege of a traditional education, the type of education that most of us, if not all of us in this room, have been lucky enough to have had. There is a quote that I love, which sums up what I'm saying. The education that is best for the best is the education that is best for all. Why did the riots happen? Because 17% of our young people are functionally illiterate and do not know the difference between right and wrong. Because the education that is best for the best is kept for only the very few. I only wish that these problems were confined to Britain. But I believe that in the West, these trends are to be found everywhere, and no doubt in Australia too. After I appeared on Late Line last night, I got 4 emails sent to me from Australian teachers around, I don't know, somewhere in Australia saying, absolutely, we have the same issues here, etc., and thank goodness someone is saying something. Now, of course, some countries, like in the UK, are simply more advanced in their decline. My advice to all of you is to learn from our mistakes in Britain. Do not go down the trendy and very tempting route of believing that all that glistens is gold. I believe in conservative values precisely because they conserve what is traditional. If Australia learns from the hideous mistakes that Britain has made, I am certain that the old school values that we have lost in Britain will ensure your country's future success. Thank you.
Many thanks, and as I mentioned, Janet Grundy down the back has got some copies of To Miss With Love. And so we come to questions and discussion. Just tell us a bit about your free school. As you know, Joel Klein from the United States came to Australia, and when Julia Gillard was education minister a few years ago and was talking about what the charter schools are doing in New York, your free school concept in Britain, or in England, I guess, has that been influenced by New York, what Joel Klein's been doing there, or are you just taking some quite different model?
Yes, I mean...
Back to the end of the room.
Yes, absolutely. It is very much based on that, on the model that America has. Although what's good is, with other countries having done it first, we can learn from their mistakes and change things. So one of the problems that has existed in America is that they weren't tight enough in the control in terms of what kinds of schools they would let set up in the first place. And sometimes some of them would spiral out of control almost immediately. So they've been very rigorous in terms of the application process and so on. 291 schools applied this year to open in September 2012, and my school was one of those, but only just over 100 were interviewed. So they culled quite a lot even before interview, and I suspect only about 40 or 50, if that, will end up getting through, which I think is a good thing, because... they have a real fight on their hands, the government, in trying to convince people. Unfortunately, the teaching unions, who are very much against free schools, have done an excellent job of spreading propaganda about the free schools. And you ask any ordinary people in the street what free schools are about, and they'll tell you things that aren't true. They'll tell you, for instance, that free schools are selective, which they can't be. And they're not. They will be comprehensive, and the reason why they are is because they have to follow the same admissions code as any other maintained school. They will tell you that free schools take money away from local schools. Again, that's just simply not true, because schools are funded on a per-pupil basis. So the unions, because they don't like the idea of schools having some freedom, because you have freedom over paying conditions, you see, as well. You can change the school day, but you can also change paying conditions. And for the unions, that is the worst possible thing. And you could write your own contract at the beginning. And so, for instance, you could, if you wanted, you could write a contract that required teachers to have a probationary year before being secure in that job. And, of course, the unions prefer teachers to have a job for life, no matter whether you're good or bad. So the unions are fighting tooth and nail in order to stop free schools from happening, and the government has a real fight on its hands, and it is a concern of the free schools who are being set up, whether, if the Conservative government does not come into power next time, whether or not they'll be allowed to stay open.
Janet, thank you.
Catherine, thank you very much for that address. It was wonderful to hear. What I don't understand is, and I guess my experience of teachers is that they're incredibly decent people, hardworking people, but then I'm one of those lucky people that live in a beefy suburb and send my children to a private school. But I was educated publicly, so I do have a high regard for teachers, but I don't understand why there are not more teachers speaking out. If they know what the problems are, they're speaking privately in the staff rooms. Why is it? What is it that they're afraid of? I mean, we need to distinguish between union leaders and union members. And presumably, if there is a wide enough acceptance of the problems, then there ought to be more teachers coming out and saying what you're saying.
Because, and I agree with you that I have the highest respect for teachers. I think it's the most challenging job in the world. It's the most rewarding job in the world. I have nothing but respect for teachers. The problem is, I mean, I lost my job when I spoke out. Teachers know you can't talk, because if you do, you'll lose your job, quite literally. So if you have children to feed and a mortgage to pay, you can't say anything. But it's more than that. It's not just about self-preservation. It's also, if you criticize the state school system, you are considered to be a traitor. The way in which the state school system is propped up is through the same all prizes for all culture, which is about saying to children who may not be doing so well, you're doing brilliantly. And the state school system that isn't doing so well, oh, you're doing brilliantly. And so everyone's patting themselves on the back about how brilliant everything is all the time. And to do otherwise is to betray the system. And because, I was trying to explain, that there is this huge kind of fight between the state and the private sectors, if you criticize the state sector, then you're kind of giving points to the other side. And you're betraying your own. So, I mean, a number of people will say to me, I should know better. How could I do this? How could I betray teachers? How could I betray ethnic minorities? How could I, you know, me coming out and speaking the truth is to somehow harm them? And of course, my point is, they always say, well, why don't you criticize the independent sector? You know, Eaton hasn't got everything right. I don't care. I don't care whether or not Eaton's got it right or wrong. You know, I don't care if Eaton could do things better for the Eaton boys, because you know what? Etonians are all going to be okay. I don't care about the independent school sector. I care about the state sector being better. Which, just like I say to the children at school, they say, well, why are you picking on me, miss? Because I care about you. I'm criticising you because I want to make you into a better human being. So I'm criticising the state school system. You've got to put your hand up and say there's a problem before you can fix the problem. But it's this culture of denial, culture of... And the teachers know it. I had teachers, well, after my speech, I had teachers literally running up to me in the street saying, thank you so much for what you said. I'm not telling you my name, but thank you. And they would run.
This was your speech at the Conservative conference in 2010.
Yes, right. That's right.
The question there,
wondering, in addition to the insightful diagnosis, you might talk about some of the prescriptions of cure. One of the debates that's occurring at the moment here, and has been occurring for a couple of years, is how do you create incentives for schools and teachers to create better outcomes, particularly in disadvantaged schools, and what's the right measure? And that's an ongoing conversation, fortunately not a debate yet, between unions, parents and government. Have some of the incentives been refined from the British experience? What can we perhaps learn about creating a cure?
Well, of course, the thing is that, like you said, it's not the teachers don't want to do well. They're working very hard. They're working all the time. They're exhausted and so on. But they're being told to do all the wrong things. So one of the things that Michael Gove has done, he's taken on the teacher training institutions, and he's said that, you know, academies, which are another form of school that we've got, and free schools don't have to employ teachers who have been trained in these institutions, because the institutions, from word go, are brainwashing the young teachers into thinking that they need to teach in these ridiculous ways that I'm suggesting here. So you need to change what you're telling teachers to do. The problem is that it's endemic in the culture. And I would argue that it would be the same here. In the West, we all think everything needs to be fun and entertaining and not boring. So you have to do something with the teacher training institutions. You need to start talking. All of you need to start talking about tradition and hyping it up. Tradition needs to be trendy, you know. And everyone needs to, and so you all need to be writing articles about it, you all need to talk about it to all your friends, everyone needs to put emphasis on that. And then the politicians in particular, people who have real power, need to take that on. But the problem is, look, I mean, I'm, to some, a figure of hate. You know, I get all sorts of hate mail, and people say horrible things about me and write horrible things about me. And so you need to find people who are willing to say things that are true and don't mind being hated. But, That's quite hard, finding people who are willing to do that. But and the unions. The number one thing, and I keep saying it in Britain, and I'll say it here, I keep saying it to everyone, until someone takes on the teaching unions, somebody needs to take... We have some, you've got one. Somebody needs to break them. They have too much power. Of course there ought to be a union that protects the working man, right? I don't believe that we shouldn't have unions. We need unions to protect the working man, but... Why are the unions telling teachers how to teach? You know, imagine if you had a union for nurses and doctors telling surgeons how to do surgery. I mean, it's absurd. And yet we accept it, that the union somehow should tell teachers how to teach. It's an awful situation. And like this woman in the front here was saying, you know, there are a number of us teachers out there who don't feel represented by the unions, but we need to be in a union in case a child accuses you of something, or you need legal representation just in case. Although what's very interesting is that my own union, when I lost my job, where was my union? When I lost my job, they completely disappeared, and some weeks later they rang me up and said, seeing as you're no longer a teacher, let's take you off the books. Now, what that means is the union is basically requiring that their teachers swallow their mantra. If you vote Conservative, then they don't want to represent you. If you don't think the way they do, they will not protect you. A union isn't meant to be about telling people how to vote. A man should be able to be protected by a union, whether he votes Conservative or Labour, whatever he thinks, right? But that isn't the situation we've got. And our politicians need to be brave enough, your politicians, my politicians, all of us, they all need to be brave enough to do something, but they're all terrified of the union. So I don't know, to be honest. Until we find another Margaret Thatcher, we're all in a whole load of trouble.
Now, I've got to be very quick, because there are a lot of people here. So there's a question up the back, then we're going to build and around here. So up the back.
Thank you so much, Catherine. I'm so glad you've come to Australia. I just wanted to know whether teachers are influenced, and I'm sure, I don't know whether in the United Kingdom they have standardised testing, as we do here, where now it would seem that there will be league tables of schools, whether they do well or whatever, from a point in time test. And teachers have been very much against that, and you know, it seems that that is the way it's going to go. Do you think that teaching to the test is lowering the standard of how teachers teach?
Yes, absolutely. And in my book, I talk a lot about that. It's a problem that you've picked up on with schooling that's very difficult to solve, because you want to be able to judge schools. And you want parents to have choice between schools and to be able to compare and say this school is better than that school and so on. The problem is, what criteria do that you then use to be able to judge those schools? And it's certainly not fair to say, well, you know, let's just judge them by who does really well in a particular test. Because you've got a whole load of bright children in one school and not so bright children here. You've got children from disadvantaged families here and not really advantaged families there. Obviously, they're going to do very differently. And it doesn't tell you what the value added is of that school. And that's really what parents want to know, is how great the teaching is. So you could have a school that has, you know, lots of middle-class children who are being supported well at home, or generally very bright, and the teachers may not be particularly good, they may be coasting along, but on paper, they would look really excellent. But the reason why we use league tables and we use results, and of course the reason why results are used is because it's very easy, isn't it? You can just look at results, and it's very easy, it's a number, and everybody can... You know. The problem is, if you want to go and look at value added, if you want to look at, because I think it's about the whole child education, you want to judge how polite the children are, you want to judge how dynamic the children are, you want to judge how interested they are in learning and so on. Well, how do you judge that? And then how do you put that in a league table? It's very difficult, you see. So it's a hard one, and I don't personally have a solution for that. I am against league tables, very much so. And that's probably one way which I diverge from the Conservative Party, because they're very much pro-league tables. But I understand why. I know the damage it does, because it just makes all teachers teach to the test. I mean, I used to say to children all the time, we would go to GCSEs, what they take at 16, and I'd be taking over a bottom set, and we would all be trying to get a C, and that's what we're aiming for. They all say, well, French, because I taught them French. And they don't want to do French, because it's hard. And I'd say, look, first lesson I'd start with them, and I'd say, don't worry. They all want to get Cs. And to get a C, you don't need to know a word of French, so it'll all be fine. And that's quite literally, I know, because I know how to get through the exam. And I know how to teach them so that they can, when I say not know how to speak, and they can just learn certain phrases parrot fashion, and I'll get them through that exam, and I'm an expert at that. But I'm not meant to be doing that, really. I'm meant to be teaching them French.
Just very quickly, what's the funding arrangement for free schools? I don't understand.
Right. So free schools are funded by the state. They're funded by the state, just like a maintained school is. The only difference is that people, so, you know, these three people in the front here, they might look at their community and say, oh, I want to set up a school. We need a school. The schools around here aren't very good, and they could set up that school. And then eventually they would get state funding for it, and it would run just like any other state school. It's just that they were the ones that set it up. And the reason why I'm so pro-free schools is because it encourages individuals to take personal and collective responsibility. They look at their communities and say, what can I do to change this? And we all need a state, right? I'm not arguing for a country without a state. We need transport sorted and our schools sorted and our hospitals. I mean, I believe in all of that. I don't believe we should have only private schools. But the fact is, too often, the existence of the state encourages people not to take responsibility. So I see in schools all the time, you know, can you pick that up, please? Well, the cleaner can do that. Well, can you push in your chair? Well, you know, premises staff can do that. It's not my responsibility. And adults do that as well, all the time. They say, well, you know, I don't have to look after that because the state is going to look after that. And so I think the state ought to have a really clear focus on trying to encourage individuals to take that responsibility themselves. And David Cameron talks about the big society, which is in opposition to the big state. We need a smaller state and a bigger society where people are encouraged to help others, to be kind, to be all those things that, you know, Jesus Christ would want us to be. I'm not religious, but, you know, once upon a time it was just obvious that that's the kind of people that we would want to be. And nowadays, everyone's lost that. And I think that's in part because we have such a huge state doing things for us.
All right, call the next question. I should have said thanks to Mellicent for the use of this facility today. It's a big crowd here. It's a great facility, so we've got to be very quick as we come towards the end.
Catherine, we have a different system here in that our private schools, the ones that are not very expensive as much as the ones that are very expensive, are supported by the state to 80%, as you've learned in the last couple of days, surprise to you. So we've had parents who've just walked from the public system and walked quite a lot in the last 20 years. What's happening to the parents? I know in your book a lot of the children are from homes where parents are sort of suffering from family dysfunction and all of that. But there's a whole lot of middle-class parents who use the public system or the state system, whatever you call it. What is the feeling among parents? I mean, how are they pressuring governments to do something different?
Well, I mean, like I said at the beginning of my talk, one of the things that really annoyed me was that we're all lying to the public all the time. I was an expert at it. I was always wheeled out at events, you know, year six parents' evenings when the parents would come round to look at the school. And I would go and talk about how marvellous everything was and how everything come to this school for these reasons, and because the schools are all trying to sell themselves. And I was the best at it. So you're a bit of a salesman all the time as a teacher, and you're constantly lying. And I don't think the vast majority of the public have any idea what is going on in our schools. And like I say at the beginning of my book, I say people, because I wrote the beginning, I wrote it thinking it was going to be anonymous, and you'll see that at the beginning. This is when it was going to come out anonymously, and I say in there, people, parents of the schools that I've taught at will read this book and think, thank goodness my child doesn't go to one of those schools. That's what they'll think. Because they don't know. Because, look, when journalists, after my speech at the Conservative Party conference, all these journalists were talking to me and so on, and they'd say, but my children go to state school and they're okay. And I'd say, really? How do you know? And they'd say, well, they're fine. I say, yeah, they come home from school, and you say, how was your day? And they say, fine. And you say, okay. And that's the end of it. How on earth do you know your children are fine? Do you know they're learning anything? And not only that, but children aren't going to tell you the details. They don't know. They don't know what's going on in other schools. They have no idea what to compare to. And so there are some parents who might be a little bit more interested, and they come and say, well, why isn't my child getting enough homework and so on? But parents tend to just be very trusting of the school system. They just assume that the schools are doing what's right by their child. They have no idea. Look, my book is about a school that's considered to be good with outstanding features, according to Ofsted. And Ofsted is our inspectorate body that comes in and inspects schools. So this, the school that's represented in here, and all of the stories are true, right? Small details have been changed. So, I don't know, there's a fight with a hammer, when in fact, I think the metal bar is in here, but the reality was a hammer. You know, so small things are changed like that. And the basic, you know, the reality of the stories are absolutely true. And people read this and they say, I've just made it up. And teachers don't. Teachers read it and say, oh, actually, in some places, it's much worse than this. And this is one of our good schools. Now, admittedly, not all of our state schools are like this. And if you are out in some leafy suburb school, it won't be as bad as this. But even there, you have all the issues of not being taught knowledge, of being taught skills, and so on, and the prizes for all culture. That will be everywhere. But they get away with it, and their children come out with some A's and A stars, and they say, oh, look, my child's got some A's and A stars at GCSE. I'm really pleased. And people don't... I don't know if it's the same here. I can't stress just how much you are a traitor as a parent too. Look, I once met this woman at a party, and she said to me how she lives in South London, near to where I live, and her children are at primary school. And primary schools aren't so bad, so you can kind of get away with your child at primary school in the state sector. And she said, well, we're going to move out of London because, you know, my child is 9 now, coming up to secondary level, and we're going to move out of London. I really don't want to, but we're going to have to. And I said, well, why don't you just send your child to private school? She said, well, we couldn't do that. We'd lose all our friends. Now, that is standard. That is standard. You are considered to be a bad person if you send your child to a private school in England. And so there's this kind of moral superiority from those who use the public school system. So what they then do is, the rich ones, they go and buy a house next to a half-decent state school, and they'll pay way over the odds for that house because it's within the catchment area of that good state school. They send their child to that state school, public school, and then they say, I'm so wonderful, I support the state system, I'm a great person, etc. And then their friends who send their children to private schools, they say, look how evil you are, you've abandoned the state sector, and it's your moral duty to have sent your children to private school. I mean, I think there's something really quite worrying about a society that encourages people to do what's bad by their children. I mean, what, a man lives for his children and his family. He goes out and he goes out into the wilderness and beats down the lion and takes the meat and feeds his family. That's the whole point about being a man. And if you can't look after your children, if the state encourages you to hurt your children for the sake of some moral righteousness, I mean, it's all upside down. You only get what's good in a good community and a good society by allowing men to be men and look after their families.
You sound like a conservative.
We don't have a lot of time. Some of us have got to go out and tackle some lions in a minute. Very quick.
Britain has greater social inequality than any other country in Europe, similar to what they have in America. Mm. But the funny thing is, apparently the poor in Britain feel, I'm stuck, I can't get out of my social class, I am this. And in America, with the same inadequacies, they feel, I can do that, I have done that, I can rise socially. You think it's the class system or something to do with what's happening in this destruction?
Well, I'm not sure they do feel that in America. I mean, I think there is the idea of the American dream, and anybody can go after, you know, and there is this sense of, in America, money is what makes you successful, whereas in Britain it's more complicated than that. It's not just about money. But, yes, I do think they feel stuck. You know, one of the arguments that's always used against benchmarking, they say, well, what about the kids in the bottom? What about the ones who aren't achieving? How awful of you to tell them that they're at the bottom. And I always say, yes, but you really think that the kids at the bottom don't know they're at the bottom? You think they don't know that they don't understand? Oh, they're not that dumb. They know they haven't understood it. And telling them that they were second to the bottom here, but third to the bottom in the next test, makes them feel like they're improving and they're doing something. But if they're just lost in this kind of fog all the time, and that's why they feel abandoned and lost and can't make any difference, because they don't even have, they're not even being told how to do it. They're not being taught anything, and some of them have dysfunctional families, so they don't get any support at home. They go into school and find chaos, and yeah, they'll come home and say, yeah, everything's all right, you know, and they have no idea. Parents don't know what's going on. They don't know. I mean, there are fights all the time. And then people say to me, oh, my standards are too high. You know, my standards really are not that high. They really aren't. I expect children to come to school on time. I expect them to be polite. I expect them to be able to sit on their chairs. And I expect teachers to do some teaching and the children to learn something at the end of it. I mean, I'm not expecting anything extraordinary. And if you read this book, honestly, you will think she's making it up. But I swear to you, I'm not making it up.
Just quickly, how has technology influenced traditional teaching values?
How has technology
influenced traditional teaching values?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. What is unfortunate is that while technology has its uses, and I visited a school here in Australia yesterday, and I was saying to the children there, I said, you know, it's great that you've got all this access to your iPads and, you know, computers and so on. But you must realize that those are just tools that allow you to access a world of information. And what's really important is that world of information. And if you spend all of your time MSNing people and, you know, Facebooking people and so on, I mean, we've got to a point where, you know, a teacher's considered to be a great you know, fantastic teacher, if we're talking about the objective of the lesson, you say to the children, now, let's all think about the objective of the lesson as if it were an update of your Facebook status, you know? I mean, it's just, it's absurd. I mean, I just, and what's unfortunate is that everybody's so driven in education that way. I mean, there's a school near me, so in the inner city, a primary school. The man who runs it is amazing. He banned local council from having anything to do with his school. He won't let them on the premises. He's just taken control, and he's done an extraordinary job with these children who are all from the local estates, and he's just an amazing, amazing principal. And he had the Ofsted inspectors in, and they said to him, oh, no, we can't give you an outstanding, because you don't have interactive whiteboards in your classrooms. And so he's now put interactive whiteboards in his classrooms, and he says to his teachers, don't worry, you don't have to use them, but we just need to have them here, because otherwise we won't get an outstanding. I mean, there's something wrong with that. You know, and I'm not saying interactive whiteboard, I use them, and I think they're quite useful in various ways, you know, but they're tools. But we've forgotten that. And then there's all sorts of papers that are written. If you use technology in your classroom, grades will go up by one. So a child who would have got a C will now get a B, simply because you're using technology in the classroom. And this is the kind of nonsense that's taught through the teacher training institutions. And we're all brainwashed by it. I have to say, the teachers, though, that's one thing they are a little bit resistant to. There's still some resistance. Unfortunately, the brainwashing in other ways, you know, has got some of them, but that at least they're a little bit resistant to.
I can't take all the questions. We've got two down the back, but you've got to be very brief.
Yes. Thank you. Yes. On the subject of aspiration and your story about Oxford, did the children get to Oxford and feel inspired by it? And did the children who were the C's say, excuse that you mentioned C's in French, say, excuse me, miss, but I'd actually rather like an A?
Well, of course, I was talking about the bottom sets. When I'm talking about going for C's, and getting a C with that bottom with bottom sets really would be quite extraordinary. But going to Oxford, and when I say bottom set, that's because they just aren't very bright. I mean, and we need to accept that. You know, some children are very bright and some aren't. That's okay. You know, everyone doesn't need to be a professor. Going to Oxford, well, that trip. I mean, they went and they found it. I mean, to give you an example of how out of how much they don't understand about the world. I remember going into one of the dining halls, and it was set, you know, the tables were set, and they were asking me, why are there two forks? Why are there two knives? And so on. They didn't have any sense of what that was, you know, and why would they, I suppose? I mean, frankly, most of them won't necessarily use knives and forks because they eat Kentucky Fried Chicken regularly and so on. So even one set of knife and fork would be odd. And to see a table set in that way would probably be unusual, especially the idea of having two forks and two knives. So these are the kinds of things. You see, what I don't think we should be doing is saying, well, see, it's the family's fault. If you don't get it from the family, then forget about it. I think so. Schools should stimulate social mobility. So what you do is you figure out what the families aren't doing, and then you do it in school. So what else are we meant to do? Otherwise, all we're doing is creating a situation where we might as well build a whole load more prisons, because that's where these children are going to end up, unless we do something in our schools to make sure that they are educated enough to get the jobs that will prevent them from going out and rioting and ending up eventually in prison.
Final question down the back.
Catherine, thanks for a great presentation. I just wanted to ask you, how important is gender balance within teaching ranks? In this country, it seems there are fewer young men wanting to be teachers. Is that an issue for you over there? And if so, what's its impact and what is to be done about it?
Yeah, people often say that. I mean, I have to say that certainly whenever I survey children about what's important in a teacher, the race of the teacher and the gender of the teacher is never important. They don't care at all. What they care is whether or not the teacher is fair, whether or not he's a good teacher, does he know his stuff, and so on. So in terms of the children's opinion, they really couldn't care less. People say that, you know, with absent fathers, you need men in the classrooms, but teachers are not parents. I don't see how teachers can possibly replace parents in that way. I actually think that and this, again, is very un-PC to say, but that's what I do. I actually think that the main problem that we've got, and this is something that we can't change, and I wouldn't want to change it, but I think in the last 60 or 70 years, say 60 or 70 years ago, women who went into teaching? Well, they were our best and brightest women. The women had the choice of secretary, maybe factory work, you know, and the best, the most intelligent of our women all became teachers. And they were the ones who ran our schools. And because of feminism, which is a good thing and I support, right, because of feminism, they are now lawyers and doctors and bankers. And so in the teaching profession, it's no longer being run by our brightest. And I think that has had a huge impact on our teaching. And so, of course, there are bright people in teaching, and there are both men and women, people who have chosen it as a career and so on. But I do think that as I say, it's very un-PC to say, but I don't think the problem is about a lack of men. I think the problem is about actually a lack of very bright both men and women.
Just a final brief question on To Miss With Love. I guess you never expected to be a best-selling author. Have you got anything else in mind? And why did you end up writing the book? And are you thinking of doing another one?
Well, I am. Not a proper book like that. Just a digital, short book. I'm thinking I want to write about why I moved to the right. You know, it's funny. My father has a friend who lives here in Sydney, who he's known for 35 years or something, who I spoke to on the phone earlier. And she said to me, you know, she said, oh, you know, you're seeing all these people and so on. And she said, oh, you know, I don't understand. How can you be frequenting with conservatives? You know, because it's just bizarre for you know, especially ethnic minorities. It's just not something that you do, because ethnic minorities are always on the left. That's just how it is, and the left historically have been very kind to us. And I said to her, because I don't believe that the left are friends in the way that you do. And I know it's hard to understand that, because you haven't had my experiences of teaching in the inner city. But I genuinely believe that conservative values, conservative ways of life, are the things that will help the children in the inner city and the poor. And that what is very unfortunate is that the dynamic is set up as, if you're on the left, you're a good person who wants to help people. And if you're on the right, you're evil and want to play golf and like lots of money to keep for yourself. And that, and I mean, there are lots of right-wingers in here, so you laugh and think, ah, oh, that's, you know. But it's true. That's how they think on the left. They think simply because they are on the left, they are morally righteous. And they are better than the people on the right. And the people on the right are only arguing what they're saying because they are evil people who want to keep all their money for themselves and who want to hurt the poor. And we have to defend the poor by believing what we believe. And that's why they hate me, because it's clear from my everything I've done in my life that it's been all about, you know, helping underprivileged children and so on. I would never work in the private sector, I have to say. I would never work in the private sector. I would only ever work with inner city children. I absolutely love them. I just love it. I love them and I love making a difference to their lives. So if I am saying that conservative values are going to help these children, see, that's why they feel betrayed. I've betrayed them, because how could I say that? Because don't you know, Catherine, the right is evil. And I want to write something that demonstrates why I've come to this way of thinking. And I do think that the right, and I say this to conservatives all over the place, and they laugh at me, but I do think conservatives don't understand just how much they're hated by the teaching profession, by the left generally, just how much they're considered to be evil. They don't ever attack that notion and say, actually, you are not the gatekeepers of morality. And the reason why we believe what we believe is not because we want to play golf and be rich. That's not what we're doing. And in fact, what I've discovered in coming to know, because I never knew any conservatives, remember, I was only friends with lefties. I, you know, used to read Marxism, Living Marxism. I said in my speech it was Marxism Today, but actually I discovered later that I used to read Living Marxism at university. And I was a very, very much on the left, right? And it's over the years that I've changed. And it's through my experiences of watching leftist policies destroy the children that I love. That is why I've changed. Conservatives don't understand. And conservatives often, because in England anyway, so many of them have been to private school, so many of them talk in a really posh fashion. So many of them, they have no idea. They don't, you know, a lot of them are rich. And so, simply by virtue of being who they are, they offend everyone else, if you see what I mean. So I want to explain to people that conservative values are good, and that they'll help the poor. My intention in giving that speech and in writing this book was I wanted to explain to the left how we could change things for the better, and how if they just listened, we could make it different. And I was very naive. I thought they would listen to me. I had no idea that they would react the way they did. I genuinely believe that they cared about the poor. I don't believe they do. I believe that they care about themselves, and that they have a sense of guilt that sits on their shoulders. In particular, white middle-class people have a guilt of, ooh, I'm white and privileged. Ooh, I'm middle-class and privileged, and I feel so bad about this. I have to go and send my children to a half-decent state school and then go around to dinner parties and say, look at me, I'm supporting the state system, and aren't I brilliant? And I want to say to them, put the guilt down. It's okay. Put it down, go and see a therapist, and then we can talk about how to make things right for our children. And so I want to write some, you know, a digital book, as I say. I mean, it would only be 15,000 words, something short, about why conservative values matter, why we all have to fight for them, why, I mean, literally, it's not so bad here. I know it's not so bad here, but you are 20 years perhaps behind. And we are a little behind America. You know, Britain isn't as bad as America. In America, you go into an inner city school, you've got 8 policemen marching down the corridors, you know? And I've got friends in these schools who teach and so on. And they've lost it. There's no getting it back in America. You know, in Britain at the moment, I think we're at a turning point. We could get it back. We could. In Britain, it's gone. In America, it's gone. And you certainly can save things here. But somehow, we need to persuade those people on the left. That's what we need to do. We need to... And they're so convinced that the right is wrong. I don't know, it's very hard. But I find with teachers, actually, and they do hate the right. They hate them. But when you look at the issues and you talk them through it, in the end, they agree with them. You know, they'll say yes, and I'll say... And then do you realise it's the Conservative Party that believes these things? And then, I mean, I struggled myself. When I stood at the Conservative Party conference and said that I voted Conservative, it was cathartic. I was telling everyone for the first time. I'd never told anyone before. I voted Conservative and didn't tell a soul. And because I was ashamed. Because one doesn't vote to the right. And then I told everyone at the Conservative Party conference, and you know what's interesting? I have a friend, so this was in October, and a month ago, so several months later, I have a friend, a black builder. He's a builder, and you know, he's never been to university or anything. He's a man of 40 years old. And he came to see me the other day, and he said, you know, Catherine, I've been meaning to tell you, but you know, in the election last year, I voted Conservative. And I said, what? All this time? I went and gave my speech to the Conservative Party. What, and you never told me? And he said, well, is it bad? And I said, well, obviously I don't think so, because I voted Conservative too. But that's what it's like for us. And what I keep saying to Conservatives is, there are people like me out there. There are ethnic minorities out there. There are teachers out there. There are people who you cannot imagine would ever vote to the right. But we are out there looking at leftist policies, going... What I say to people, it's like I was in a boat that was sinking. And all the time I was throwing water out of the boat. And that's all I was doing. When my teaching career, I was throwing water out of the boat. And you're so busy throwing water out of the boat, you don't see what's going on around you. You don't know why it is the boat is sinking. You're just there doing this all the time. And every now and again you look out. But if the Conservative Party isn't trying to tell me how their policies will work for me and my children, if they're not reaching out to us, if they're not showing us why it makes sense, then of course all we're doing is this, and we keep going back into the polls and voting to the left all the time without thinking. And I think that is the fault of the Conservatives. The Conservatives are too blinkered. They all sit round in rooms patting each other on the backs and saying, oh, we're Conservatives, this is all so wonderful, blah, blah, blah. But actually what they need to do is they need to look outside. Because there are a whole load of people out there like me, and we can be one, right? And if we can be one, and that, sir, when you say, what is the solution? That is what needs to happen. The conservative values that you all have, you need to spread them.
Yes, sir. We got to go and play golf. Okay. We're about to turn.
about to turn the lights on for our evening golf classes, so I'm going to be very brief. I know there are other people who want to ask questions here. I couldn't take everyone on board. Catherine Verbalsing's off to Canberra tomorrow on the first Qantas flight, and down there she's meeting Tony Abbott. She's got meetings with the Prime Minister's office, and her trip in Canberra has been hosted by the Liberal MP Tony Smith and by the Labour MP Michael Danby. So there's a good conservative social democratic contribution there. I thought it was a wonderful night tonight. It was a great speech, but also a wonderful performance. I think it was more than just a speech. I think it was a great performance. So, and I'm delighted we had you, because I cannot think of a better way for us to say thanks to Jim and Jeanette Bain on the occasion of our inaugural Jim and Jeanette Bain lecture. So well done, Catherine, and thanks to the Bains. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.